The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Hey, good afternoon and welcome, ladies and gentlemen. This is Gino Geraci. So glad you could join me on the program Crosswalk with Gino Geraci. It is, of course, the program where we typically take your calls and answer your questions about the things you care the most about. We talk about God and we talk about the historical Jesus. We talk about the Bible. We talk about worldviews and world religions. If you'd like to join me on the program, the number is 303-873-1935. And of course, producer Jim Nichols is standing by to take your call at 303-873-1935. He'll ask you what your question is, and we will make every effort to get your question on the program. And of course, this evening, the President of the United States is going to give his State of the Union address. And for the past couple of weeks, I've been talking a little bit about the State of the Union by quoting the American Worldview Inventory by George Barna, who basically asks the question, how can we bridge the growing divisions in our nation? Since Ronald Reagan, it's been customary for the President of the United States to say the state of the union is strong. And I'm wondering if that's true. Is the state of the union strong? And how can we characterize the state of the union as strong when we are $34 trillion in debt? And I strongly suggest that the president isn't going to address this issue, even though it is a catastrophic issue. And if you think about it, this isn't something that is a Republican problem versus a Democrat problem. This is a national problem. And there doesn't seem to be voices, whether liberal or conservative, that are addressing what I suspect is a catastrophe. Now, some people would say, well, we're $1 trillion in debt. What's the big deal? We're $10 trillion in debt. What's the big deal? We're $20 trillion in debt. What's the big deal? And now we're $34 trillion in debt. And so what really is the threshold? What is the threshold where people will say we have an unsustainable debt? 303-873-1935 if you'd like to join me on the program. Like I said, it's easy to do. You pick up the phone, you dial the number 303-873-1935. Of course, Friendly Jim will say, hey, what's your question? And we'll make every effort to get your question or your comment on the program. And again, there's several different news sources that America's debt is growing by $1 trillion every 100 days. And economists are warning that if Congress doesn't take substantial action, it's only going to get worse. And see, what I would wonder is, for the American people, at what point will they say, we're not? So tonight, the president is going to suggest that we raise taxes on corporate America, as if that's going to be the solution. Give the government more money. Give them more money. Is that the solution to the problem? So the United States national debt, the money our federal government borrows. So if we ask and we answer the question, what is the United States national debt? This is the amount of money that the federal government borrows to cover its operating expenses. And if that's not bad enough, the rapid rise in interest rates has pushed the annual payments on the debt higher and higher and higher, which some see as this is going to reach an unsustainable threshold. So right now we're paying about $750 billion a year simply in interest costs, which again is approximately equal to every dime we spend on the national defense. So Dr. Alexander Salter, who's the associate professor of economics at Texas Tech University, is laying out the problem. And Dr. Salter says some forecasts predict the interest payments alone will soar past $1 trillion and then could double by 2033, $2 trillion in interest. So according to the Peter G. Peterson's Foundation, that's more than America will spend on the Department of Defense, $816.7 billion in 2023, national security, $30.3 billion, federal spending on children, $761 billion, and several supplemental programs. So if you go to the U.S. national debt clock, you can watch it just soar right before your eyes. $34,491 billion. What that translates to is that every United States citizen owes $102,562. Now, that's good news for illegal aliens because they don't owe anything, right? The debt per taxpayer is $266,499. Now, when you think about the debt per citizen, that's different from the debt for taxpayers because not everybody pays taxes. In the United States federal spending, the official amount, $6,470 billion and change. The United States federal budget deficit as of this moment, just simply for this year, $1,774 billion plus. So the United States federal debt to the GDP ratio in 1960 was 53.16%. In 1980, it was 34.5%. In 2000, it was 58.86%. And now it's 123.47%. That means we are exceeding the spending by 125%. It also explains how the biggest drivers of the national debt isn't simply driven by drunken sailors, government spending. It's fueled by Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. Spending on those programs leaves the federal government an estimated $200 trillion in future obligations. And guess what? The baby boomers are coming not just of age, but the largest population in the post-World War II population is now, well, way over 65. So, when you think about all of that stuff and you start throwing around these numbers, it becomes even more difficult to sustain. 303-873-1935. And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Would love to hear from you. 303-873-1935. 873-1935. I've been talking a little bit about the national debt coming in at $34 trillion, and now the projections are that we will increase the debt by $1 trillion every 100 days. Now, even when I use the word trillion, there are a lot of people who think, what is that number? What is $1 trillion? How in the world can I communicate that number in a way that makes sense? Because it's such an incredible number. I'm trying to come up with an illustration. $1 trillion is a one followed by 12 zeros. So again, think about it. Three zeros, 100. Four zeros, 1,000. 10,000. 100,000. Now, go keep going to 000. So think of $1 trillion as 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 sets of zeros. I'm trying to come up with an illustration of just how large that number is. Hopefully I can think about it and I'll come up with an illustration. But I guess what I'm going to do is talk about debt. And what does the Bible have to say about debt? And so when we're talking about the government and we're talking about personal debt and we're talking about what the Bible has to say about it, of course, Paul talks about it in Romans chapter 13, verse 8. He basically says, owe no one anything except to love each other. For the one who loves another has fulfilled the law. Now, obviously, the point is being beholden, but I think it's a powerful reminder of God's distaste for all forms of debt that aren't being paid. You know, in Psalm 37, verse 21, it says, the wicked borrows but does not pay back, but the righteous is generous and gives. So when the Bible talks about debt, it puts it in terms of being wicked. I mean, in this sense, the wicked borrows but does not pay back. That doesn't mean that you can't borrow and pay it back. The whole point becomes, if for whatever reason you decide to borrow, make sure you pay it back. And then the contrast in Psalm 37:21 is between the righteous and then the wicked. The righteous is generous. So not only does the righteous give, the righteous is generous. At the same time, the Bible doesn't explicitly command against all forms of debt. The Bible warns against debt and extols the virtue of not going into debt, but doesn't forbid debt. The Bible has harsh words of condemnation for lenders who abuse those who are bound to them in debt, but doesn't condemn the debtor. So some people question the charging of any interest on loans, but several times the Bible says that we can seek a fair interest rate and that a fair interest rate is expected to be received on borrowed money. Now, of course, among the Jewish people, there was this sense in which you don't charge usury to your brothers. That means other Jewish people. It says, whoever multiplies his wealth in Proverbs 28:8, whoever multiplies his wealth by interest and profit gathers it for him who is generous to the poor. And in Matthew chapter 25, verse 27, it says, then you ought to have invested my money with the bankers, and at my coming I should have received what was my own with interest. He's talking about the parable of the talents and the admonition, actually rebuke, of the person who of the person who refused to invest the money properly. Now, as I was talking about debt and $1 trillion, a friend sent me a note. Thank you, Dave, for this note. He's giving an analogy. He says a trillion is 1,000 billion, and it's a million. So the analogy that he gives is a stack of $1 billion bills, a stack of $1 billion would be 67.866 miles high. A stack of $1 billion is 67.8 miles high. A stack of $1 trillion is 67,866 miles into outer space. A trillion bills laid end to end would stretch 96 plus million miles. So so a trillion bills laid end to end, you could create, imagine a string that stretched from the earth to the sun. That's amazing. So now think about it. If $1 trillion would reach 67,000 miles into outer space, $1 trillion bills, $1 trillion laid end to end would be 96 million plus miles. That is a lot. So now think about it in terms of 34 trillion, and it's an unfathomable number. And so the ancient Israel law did prohibit charging interest on one category of loans. That was to the poor in Leviticus chapter 25, verses 35 through 38. So the law had many social and financial and spiritual implications, but two are really worth mentioning. First, the law genuinely helped the poor by not making their situation worse. Now, I was listening to a person who was talking about voting. And this particular person said that they were a lifelong Democrat because they believed the Democrat Party was looking out for the poor and for blacks. And this particular person said, I've come to the realization that that's not true, that the Democrat platform isn't simply to look out for blacks and the poor. And so the law genuinely helped the poor by not making their situation worse. And that seems to be a principle. The government's job isn't to make the citizen's life worse. This is Gino Geraci. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Do you plan to listen to the State of the Union address? 303-873-1935. I haven't made up my mind. I suspect that I will. I feel like I owe it to myself to at least listen to what the president has to say. And I've been talking a little bit about debt, and I'm wondering if the subject of debt is going to come up in the State of the Union address. I doubt it. I doubt if there's going to come a comprehensive plan to deal with unrestricted illegal immigration. I doubt if there's going to be a plan to pay down the debt. But as we were talking about debt and what the Bible has to say about debt, the law, like I said, had, and the Bible has many social, financial, and spiritual instructions. And I've devoted a great deal of time talking about what the Bible has to say about money, and I would love to do that again. I might just do that in the second hour. But the law taught an important spiritual lesson. So the law basically genuinely helped the poor by not making their situation worse. It was bad enough to have fallen into poverty, and it could be humiliating to seek assistance. But if in addition to repaying the loan, a poor person had to bear the burden of crushing interest payments, the obligation became even more painful. And so for the lender to forego interest on a loan to a poor person was an act of mercy. He would be losing the use of that money while it was loaned out. Yet there would be a tangible way of expressing gratitude to God for his mercy in not charging his people interest for the grace he has extended to them. So just as God had mercifully brought the Israelites out of Egypt when they were nothing but penniless slaves and had given them a land of their own, that's in Leviticus chapter 25, so he expected them to express kindness to their own poor citizens. And so Christians are in a parallel situation. The life, death, and resurrection of Jesus has paid our debt, our sin debt, to God. And so as we have opportunity, we can help others in need. The Bible talks about help everyone. But by all means, particularly fellow believers, with loans that don't escalate their troubles. Jesus even gave a parable along those lines about creditors and then attitudes about forgiveness in Matthew chapter 18, verses 23 through 35. So the Bible doesn't expressly forbid or condone the borrowing of money. The wisdom of the Bible teaches us that it's usually not a good idea to go into debt. Debt essentially makes us a slave to the one who provides the loan. And at the same time, in some situations, going into debt becomes a kind of necessary evil. And again, our challenge is to use money wisely and repay debt. And so, again, when you think about just simply the principle of debt, imagine our corporate, national identity is deeply, deeply wed to the problem of debt. 303-873-1935. That's the number if you want to join me on the program. And, of course, we're getting lots of new questions at gotquestions.org, your questions, biblical answers. Would love, love, love to share some of those. But, again, if you want to join me on the program, it's 303-873-1935, 303-873-1935. A lot of the articles that were populating at Got Questions include very simple answers to some of the significance of the kinds of information about, like, who wrote the book of Numbers, who wrote the book of Exodus? What's the core message of the major prophets? What's the core message of the minor prophets? And all of those things are very, very helpful. One of the questions that I noticed is about the Christian Coalition of America. And that's an interesting question because of the things that have changed over the years. And today, the Christian Coalition of America is a 501c3, what's called a social welfare nonprofit. And I'll get to that as well, but I guess I can talk a little bit about it now. I just had Bill Federer on a couple of weeks ago, and he's on the board of directors of Regent University, which was in part of the 700 Club and Pat Robertson and all of that. It's interesting. I was listening to another radio broadcast, and the people who were hosting the program were talking about being raised in a Christian home and watching the 700 Club at their grandmother's house or something similar to that, and how completely bored they were. Now, this is interesting to me in and of itself because, again, of this deep, deep cultural immersion into Christian principles and then a growing disconnect from Christian principles. But the Christian Coalition of America started off as a grassroots conservative political organization advocating for the rights of people of faith in the United States. In other words, it starts off with, well, why can't Christians have a voice in the public square? And, of course, it was founded by Pat Robertson and in 1987 to mobilize and inform Christian voters. And the advocacy group was comprised of supporters from a number of different various Christian denominations, including, well, mainline Protestants and Catholics and Baptists and Pentecostals. And so today, the Christian Coalition of America is called a 501c, I want to say a class four social welfare nonprofit. And the organization was established by Pat Robertson during the months leading up to his run for the Republican presidential nomination in 1988. So that was a long time ago. So Pat Robertson withdrew from the race before the primaries, and he used the resources that were accumulated during the campaign to kickstart the coalition's operations. So the Christian Coalition was first directed by American political consultant and lobbyist Ralph Reed. And then the organization set up independent chapters in 49 states, claiming tax exemption and then operating under the status while its application was pending. And in the 1996, the Federal Election Commission filed suit against the Christian Coalition, accusing the group of endorsing and donating to candidates running for federal office, which was basically prohibited by entities with tax-exempt status. So it's pretty interesting history. 303-873-1935. I know my friend Jack Hibbs has come under attack because of his prayer in Congress. There are those people calling for his 501c3 to be revoked, his nonprofit status to be revoked. I don't think it's going to go anywhere. It's Gino Geraci. Hey, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Gino Geraci encouraging you to call 303-873-1935, 303-873-1935. Let's see who's up. Susie, welcome to the program.
Hi there. Can you hear me all right?
I can. Use your big voice. Use your radio voice.
Okay. I've been listening to you the last couple days, and I have so many different thoughts and comments on all this, but a couple different things. So first of all, regarding the State of the Union speech,
Yeah.
I can't imagine with the amount of debt that this country is piling up and also with the number of people coming into this country, I can't imagine that that wouldn't be addressed. That seems to me that that would just be such
obvious.
A plan
yeah.
to the American people.
I hope you're right, and we're going to find out, aren't we? He will address it or he won't.
We'll be on the conversation, but I just look and I think I can't imagine having that many people come into our country and having so many problems and not having some kind of solution or even bringing this up. So I'm glad you brought that up. I think I may watch it just to see on that. But the other thing I was thinking about is you've been talking about debt, and then the other day you were talking about should Christians should they serve in political office?
Right.
And something that I really think about all the time is this. If you're not a Christian, what defines right and wrong?
That's a very good question because, as you can imagine, non-Christians, unbelievers, have a sense of what is right and wrong and good and evil. But you're exactly right. On what basis do you make that decision? Now, for many, many people, the decision might be based culturally, or it might be based on conscience. And so when you talk about the basis of morality, you can imagine that for some people, they'll say, this is right. So imagine God has given every human being a conscience, what I call a moral governor inside of their heart saying, this is right and this is wrong. The way I think about the conscience is, It's a moral organ that compels you to do what's right. So imagine there's something inside of you that says, do what's right, do the right thing. But in order to come up with an answer to that question, they have to go to an outside source. Have you ever heard a person say, this is right for me? This is right
yes.
for me. And so there is a sense in which there are people who intuitively, if you want to use that term, understand that stealing is wrong or that lying is wrong. And it usually is defined in terms of what happens to them. You never understand just how wrong it is to violently hurt someone until they've hurt you. They've stolen from you. They've lied to you. So imagine a person says there's no such thing as truth and evil, or there's no such thing as truth. And you ask them the question, has anyone ever lied to you? and so when you answer that question, but see, think about that, Susie, for just a moment. The very fact that we can make a statement, he lied to me or she lied to me, implies that there is such a thing as truth. Or else lie becomes something that's meaningless. And so,
okay.
And so the question becomes, what should be? And in the Christian worldview, we have two foundational principles. There's a God who exists, and that God has spoken to us in the Bible. Now imagine people with another worldview. A God doesn't exist, or if there is a God, we can't know him. And if we can't know him, he has nothing to say to us. So what are the presuppositions that require a basis for morality? And so for many people, it's cultural and collective. Well, we've all just decided that this is right or that this is wrong. And so, as you can imagine, depending on how deeply rooted you are in some sort of moral mooring, that's going to determine how flexible your morality is going to be. So if there is a God who exists, for instance, and God has spoken in his word, and he's talked about certain issues, has he changed his mind about lying, stealing, or sexual promiscuity? So these are all things that I think about.
Well, so another example of that is how many people have said to me, well, I don't believe in abortion, but I don't believe I should tell somebody else what they should do.
Imagine a person said, I don't believe in slavery, but who am I to tell people whether or not they should own slaves?
That's right. Correct. And it goes down to...
So, but you then, pause and you think about that. So you're asking a question. Is there something fundamentally wrong about slavery? Is there something fundamentally morally wrong about having an abortion? Is it the painful killing of an innocent child? Is that what an abortion is? Or is it something else? Is owning a person slavery, or is it something else?
I think that's a great question to look at and to go deeper and go, what that's opening my eyes. What is the root of what somebody's saying on that? So it goes back to, you know, when I look at abortion and I think of that, I think we've gotten away from 30 years ago when deciding when what defines birth, what defines life. Now that isn't even a conversation. What's a life? What's a baby? That's not even a conversation. And now, well, it's all about a woman's, now it's all about a woman's choice, right?
And yeah, yes. And even to the question that you just said, imagine you're a person who doesn't believe there is such a thing as God, but you believe that there's such a thing as life. And now you have to come up with an answer of how does life begin? What is life exactly? Mm-hmm. But I am going to try and determine what life is disconnected from God and disconnected from the revelation of God. But I still want to know what life is. Is it just a some sort of biological consequence that emerges out of chemistry? And so the Bible says something entirely different about the Gentiles. In Romans chapter 2, verse 15, it says, they show the work of the law written on their hearts, while their conscience who bears witness and their conflicting thoughts accuse them or excuse them. So the Bible already tells us that deep inside the human psyche is a situation that's asking and answering the question, is this right? Is this wrong? Uh-huh. Is this right? Is this wrong?
Uh-huh.
Hey, but thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Oh, make sure you call back. Bye-bye. 303-873-1935. I know we have another caller on the line. I hope that you plan to stay with me, because I would love to hear your question. And, you know, again, I was talking a little bit about the basis of morality. And the Bible, in my view, which contains God's revelation, it contains a revelation of moral will, about law, commandments. And so the Bible, I think, becomes the source of morality, because the Bible is the very word of God. But imagine a person says, nah, that's not for me. Well, they still have to have a basis of morality, and for them, it's usually some sort of social consensus. I'll be back.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.